Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Cell phone technology was introduced to the public in 1945, but the notion would not become commonly embraced for another four decades. In his new book, economist Thomas Hazlett writes about the role that federal regulators and special interests played in the delays. Professor Thomas Hazlett is a noted expert in regulatory economics and information markets. He is director of the Information Economy Project at Clemson University, where he teaches economics. His new book is entitled The Political Spectrum: The Tumultuous Liberation of Wireless Technology from Herbert Hoover to the Smartphone. Welcome to the show.
Thanks. Very glad to be here.
How was the technology viewed at the time, back in 1945? Was it something like out of, you know, science fiction, right up there with jetpacks or what?
Yeah, well, there were Dick Tracy watches, remember?
That's right.
And, of course, there always has been a sort of a fascination with this idea. We see it in Star Trek and on through pop culture. But what was happening post-war, there were radios, and certainly television was coming in, and there was some interest in mobile phones. In fact, there was the older mobile phone technology that was not nearly as efficient and couldn't have the mass market implications. That actually was rolled out in the late 1940s, but you're talking about essentially 44 channels per market, and so even in large cities like St. Louis or New York City, you're only able to get a few dozen phone calls transmitted over the air at one time. They didn't use the new cellular, where they would reuse radio spectrum from cell to cell, and they'd be able to keep dividing a market up into little pieces and use much lower power radios that would go to the local base station and then transmit, as we all know today, following the user as the user walks around or drives around or, you know, goes from area to area. So at any rate, the new cellular technology was put on the back burner, and it, you know, wasn't until the mid-1980s that it came into the market.
Which sounds pretty shocking. There were lots of just bureaucratic delays?
Yes, absolutely. And part of this, of course, forms because interested parties in the marketplace are not, you know, not pushing to get it out, and some are actively pushing against it. The major players in cellular were AT&T, and they had developed and were developing the technology. Bell Labs was a noted innovator for scientific ideas, and it took on a great many challenges and was really one of the most impressive research organizations the world has ever seen. But as a corporation, AT&T thought that, you know, they already had, you know, essentially a monopoly over local and long-distance telecommunications in the United States. They didn't see a big interest in trying to, in essence, cannibalize their own business. They did ask for licenses starting in 1958. The FCC just sat on that request for literally a decade, didn't even open up a proceeding until 1968. At the same time, the request to do wireless cellular telephone was for some frequencies, to use frequencies that had been assigned to television. And the television broadcasters were very, very strong that they did not want any of their bandwidth, so to speak, didn't belong to them, but they, you know, they had a proprietary interest and they at the regulator, and they argued very strongly against peeling any of that spectrum away for other services. And so there was a standoff for decades.
We're talking about why it took so long for a cellular phone technology to hit the streets in the United States. My guest is Thomas Hazlett. He has written a new book on the topic. It's entitled The Political Spectrum: The Tumultuous Liberation of Wireless Technology from Herbert Hoover to the Smartphone. Was it intrinsically political, or was it, you know, that special interests were having their way with Congress at the time and the FCC, or was it even less nefarious than that?
Well, yeah, all of the above. There's some things that you know, do smack of crony capitalism and tend to get people riled up, and then some of it is bureaucratic inertia, and a lot is just plain ignorance, which, you know, we're all subject to. We don't know, in 1945 or 1975 that cellular telephones are going to be a killer application and you know, have 300 million subscribers and really change the way society operates. In fact, even through the 1980s, when the allocations were finally made, two licenses in each market for the original cellular systems, one that went to an affiliate of AT&T, and then the other that went to a so-called non-wireline or non-phone company to promote some competition. That was a big breakthrough, the idea that you could have two firms competing. That was radical in the day. And in fact, in the 1970s, the FCC, Federal Communications Commission, the regulator, they had decided that only one company could actually be in that market, and that one company had to be AT&T. So this was gradually over time, through an erosion of the old assumptions about monopoly, we did get a much broader liberalization. And of course, the 1980s, when we saw how robust and popular the service was, it did feed momentum for broader competition and more open markets. I should say that all through the 80s, the assumption of the regulators, and you know, I cite a lot of this in the book, was that cellular would be a very niche market, and that only you know, wealthy folks, in some cases salespeople, who had an intense demand to be in contact on a mobile basis, but very few people would have cell phones. And McKinsey and Company in 1980 did what in the industry became a famous study, where they were commissioned by the old AT&T to try to project 20 years forward how much you know, how much cellular might produce in terms of subscribership. They said, about 900,000. That's all it would be in 2000. Well, in 2000 we had over 100 million. So they were off by, you know, more than two orders of magnitude, and that was a private sector forecast. So it's not all just government inertia, and it's not all just this sort of lobbying by companies that are opposed to new technology. It's our veil of ignorance. We just don't know what's going to happen. If we allow competition and innovation to come into the market, we're going to be pleasantly surprised in many instances.
Right, the veil of ignorance, a lack of vision.
Yeah, I mean, there could have been a vision that said, let's open this market up and see who wants to invest, and let's have more competition. There's no question that these systems were hidebound, and it goes all the way back to the 1927 Radio Act, where you do have, and this is the subtitle of the book, but you do have Herbert Hoover, who was Secretary of Commerce before he was president, and he was really the sponsor of the early radio industry, and very close to the private sector as Secretary of Commerce, and a very intelligent man with understanding. He was a professional engineer, quite a highly successful engineer. So the technology did not intimidate him, but he had a very strong passion for public-private partnerships and for administrative procedures to work through Washington with help from large corporate interests, and that's really the kind of solution that was fashioned to the radio spectrum allocation problem in 1927, the Radio Act, signed by Coolidge, but really a brainchild of a Secretary of Commerce. Now, the first successful radio stations, commercial stations, they were totally in favor of this system. They wanted public interest, that's a term of art, public interest allocation of radio spectrum. They did not like the initial rule, which was an old common law rule from 1920 to 1926 of first come, first serve. That would allow potentially new entrants to come into the market and to compete with the established stations. And so by funneling a political process into the market through the Radio Act, first became the Radio Commission 1927, and that was rolled over into the Federal Communications Commission 1934. The system we have today. By doing that, there could be a political spectrum where the more powerful incumbents could have outsized influence on who could come into the market and compete, what technologies they could use, and what services they could offer. That worked well for the incumbent regulators and political actors like Hoover, who wanted more discretion over what was said and who said it. And it also worked well for the incumbent radio stations.
At the same time, in 1945, of course, the country was becoming entranced with television, right? I mean, there was sort of this competing interest, and you wrote that television was the focus, and that's the way they prioritized it at the FCC.
Absolutely. And so television was getting allocations, and generous allocations, and that was promoted in large measure by NBC and CBS, the two emergent radio networks that had come out of AM radio in the 1920s, and they were in line to get TV licenses, and they did. And this is way before there were auctions, so they were getting very lucrative federal rights without payment, and that was a very profitable thing for them to focus on, and they were very influential. I should say, 1945 was another big event. It wasn't directly related to cellular, but it shows you some of the problems for entrance into the market. There had been a terrific whiz-bang technology in the 1930s by a great inventor who had been part of AM radio, but now had developed a competitor, FM radio, Edwin Howard Armstrong. And he had, after years of struggle, finally gotten some licenses and gotten his technology out right before World War II. And his FM radio it got rave reviews, high fidelity, much better than AM. And he got about 500,000 of these big radio consoles sold, and in the Northeast, they were broadcasting by 1941. Then at the end of 41, U.S. enters World War II, all civilian radio production stops. Armstrong himself goes into the military, and does military radios for the United States, very patriotic. At the end of World War II, now civilian production is starting in again. The projections were 5 million FM radios per year would be sold because of how well the rollout had gone. But what the FCC does at the behest of television interests is to actually uproot the entire FM radio band. The entire FM band was moved, making all the radio receivers obsolete, all the transmitters obsolete for that matter. There had to be new technologies devised. And it was shifted from 42 to 50 megahertz to 88 to 108. Now, that was over the wild and loud objections of Armstrong and all the FM champions, and it really destroyed their technology. And it wasn't until the 1960s when FM, when it finally got some further regulatory relaxation, that they was able to fully compete. Of course, when it finally did compete with AM, within a short number of years, it swamped it in terms of audience because its quality was so good. But Armstrong died a defeated man. He actually committed suicide in 1954 in large measure because of this disaster with his invention. But this is what's happening at the end of World War II. Television is moving in, and those broadcasters, those interests have a lot of clout, and there were huge allocations of airwaves made for their new service.
You wrote about the irony that Motorola was among those special interests who suppressed cellular technology. Motorola's, of course, their relationship with the television industry, they got on board, but nowadays it just seems so ironic.
Yeah, well, it is ironic. Now, this is something that happens with this very political system we developed for spectrum allocation. As I say, the 1927 Act is still with us 90 years later today. But what happens with Motorola, which was a great innovative company, no question, and they were early leaders on the frontiers of technology and all the way until the modern era, but they saw their interest, their economic interest, is tied to a very small market called the RCC, Radio Common Carrier Market, which was about 500,000 radio sets. And obviously, you know, cellular today, over 300 million subscribers. But Motorola had that locked up, and they thought they were making healthy profits there. And they actually opposed and turned against some of the plans in the 70s and 80s when cellular was finally getting traction and coming out into the market. The licenses started flowing 1984 to 89 out of the Federal Communications Commission. Motorola was actually very resistant to that. Now, the irony, of course, is that Motorola became the second leading international vendor for cell phones, second only to Nokia, as recently as the mid-2000s. And so they had a huge business in front of them. But they were trying to protect a very small business where they were dominant, and they wanted to keep the status quo because they thought that new players would come into the market and compete against them, which, of course, did happen, whether it be Nokia or LG or Apple or, you know, BlackBerry or all the Android devices today. And, of course, now, over the last 10 years, we can see Motorola's had a very tough time. It sold its handset division a few years back to Google. But, it has had trouble competing in that bigger market. But they had a great run in cellular, and they actually opposed most of the allocations.
You've argued that the battle is not even half won. What do you mean by that?
Well, today, as we sit here, we can see that there has been enormous progress, and that is we did allow a lot more spectrum to get into the market with very flexible rules. And you can see it, you know, most obviously in the mobile market, where carriers compete against each other. They build very large network infrastructure. There are all kinds of innovation ecosystems, the app stores, the services, the content that can come in. You can get over the top through wireless, all kinds of services that come through and usually come around the carriers but are accommodated by those networks. The fact is, however, that we have only gotten that space, which, as we sit here 10 years now, the iPhone having its anniversary this month, you can see that the iPhone gets to come in and get access to radio spectrum in a way that, for example, Edwin Howard Armstrong couldn't in the 1930s or 40s. He had to ask permission to use his radios, and he only got what the FCC, the regulators, were willing to give him. Apple gets to go into the market in 2007 by literally playing the private firms, the competitors in the mobile space against each other, and at the end of the day, they got paid by the mobile carriers to actually put their radios in the market, and there was a spectrum store open for them to actually get radio waves for their spectrum. Now, that's a very liberal system compared to what we had, and we have gotten tremendous innovation, but that only takes place on airways that have been specifically opened up for competition. And most of the spaces that we have in terms of productive radio spectrum today are still walled off in legacy allocations that took place decades ago. Many of these are for things like television. The 1952 TV allocation table still consumes 49 channels of over-the-air TV as we sit here, even though that transmission has gone to cable, satellite, and now over the top broadband. Of course, the military, the Federal Aviation Administration, the Department of Justice, all these federal agencies and state and local as well have been given allocations. They're very sticky, very rigid, and they're very specific, meaning that new technologies are not allowed without new permissions that take years or decades to deploy in the marketplace. And so we have to, and this is common knowledge in the spectrum world, and everybody is grappling with it, we have to come up with better ways to free the spectrum and not have a 10 or 20-year regulatory process just to allow new technology that's useful to consumers and the public to get into the market.
Thomas Hazlett, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Thomas Hazlett is a professor of economics at Clemson University and author of a new book entitled The Political Spectrum, The Tumultuous Liberation of Wireless Technology from Herbert Hoover to the Smartphone. More Tech Tuesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. By now, the connection between social media and terrorist networks has been popularly established. Even the most casual observer knows about how ISIS uses Twitter to amplify the psychological impact of terrorist attacks, not to mention its success in recruiting. But are the purveyors of social media, the Facebooks and Twitters of the world, therefore culpable for terrorism and liable in a court of law? Journalist Nina Brown wrote about the topic recently for Slate. She is an assistant professor at Newhouse School of Public Communications at Syracuse University. She joins us now. Welcome to the show, Nina Brown.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
How is the impact of social media on the spread of terrorism measured?
Well, at this point, we only have outside measurements, such as those who are taking a look at Twitter, a look at Facebook, and seeing just how much these terrorist messages are spreading. About 2 years ago, or maybe 3 years ago, the prevalence of terrorists online using these social media platforms really started to multiply. And since that time, there has been a question of what responsibility and what role the social networks have to play in stopping them or in trimming the use. Social media is in the best position to give us those numbers of just how many accounts are being held by terror organizations. But those numbers have not been forthcoming. So any measurement we have is really from outside observers. And the accuracy at this point could be improved only by collaboration with the social networks.
Families of victims of terrorism have argued that social media bears some of the responsibility for the attacks. The first claim was filed last year by the widow of a military contractor killed in Jordan. What was her claim?
Her claim was actually really simple. She argued that she sued just Twitter, and she said by allowing terrorists to radicalize potential recruits, to fundraise, to spread propaganda, that Twitter essentially shared responsibility for her husband's death. Twitter, she argued, had the knowledge that ISIS and other terrorist organizations used its platform and was exceptionally successful in doing so. And were it not for Twitter, ISIS wouldn't have been as successful at engaging recruits. And the lone wolf gunman who killed her husband had been radicalized online by ISIS and followed ISIS on Twitter.
Since then, how many others have filed claims against social media companies?
There have been five since that point, and I'm not sure that we've really even seen how many, have any idea of how many are going to be forthcoming. I think that all hinges on how successful these most recent suits have been. The lawsuit you mentioned that took place, Fields versus Twitter, that was filed in January of 2016, has already been dismissed. And in fact, another lawsuit that was based on some of the same basic arguments filed after that point has also been dismissed. And the reason that those lawsuits were dismissed were that the arguments they made, the basis for liability, was that Twitter and in the subsequent lawsuit, Facebook, provided ISIS accounts, and that by providing them accounts, they bore some liability. But unfortunately for the plaintiffs, there is a really robust federal law that immunizes just an incredible amount of liability for websites. So this federal law is Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, and it protects websites, including social networks, from civil liability when they engage in really traditional editorial publishing functions. So this would be deciding whether to publish content, to remove content, to edit posts, tweets, or really any content that's going to be generated by a third party, by a user of the site. So, Anne, for example, if I am on Facebook and I make a defamatory post about you, I may face my liability for what I wrote. But if you sue Facebook, they're going to be immunized by Section 230, unless Facebook actually solicited that content or wrote that content. So, and that's because 230 doesn't immunize a website when it creates that content.
All right. So on another level, one level, federal law allows victims to sue media companies that provide material support.
Right.
But federal law, as you mentioned, the Section 230 also protects websites from civil liability when they are just doing the job of publishing content by third parties. So that's the rub.
Right.
Where do you see legally that victims' rights eclipse those of the companies?
Well, so this is the evolution in the lawsuits that we've been seeing.
Mm-hmm.
So these first lawsuits get dismissed because 230 provides immunity. These new plaintiffs are taking a new approach, and I think it's one that might get them around 230. It doesn't mean that they're going to be successful on their ultimate claim. They still are going to have to prove, as you said, that there's material support. And there are a few elements there that plaintiffs are going to need to get through. But this new legal approach that they're taking, I think could get them past the Section 230 defense. And that's that the, and now the, of course, the defendants have expanded past just Twitter and Facebook, and now YouTube, which is owned by Google, are defendants. And plaintiffs are arguing that you're not just providing them accounts, which, okay, maybe 230 immunizes that. But now you're actually profiting on ISIS's use of your site because you have these algorithms that are pairing the posts by ISIS to raise money, to spread propaganda, et cetera, with advertisements that are targeted at those that are going to be interested in the type of posts by ISIS. And that, the plaintiffs argue, is actually creation of content. Not only is it creation of content, but you're deriving a profit from it. And particularly in the case of Google, YouTube, some of that profit may be shared with the content provider, which is, of course, ISIS. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's going to be really interesting as these cases go through their initial motions to dismiss, how judges decide whether 230, what the impact of 230 is with this type of claim.
Plaintiffs need to show that Twitter or Facebook knew that terrorists were using the service. And that sounds hard, but you write that it's not.
Yeah, it's probably, I mean, again, this is going to be if they get past 230,
yeah,
the plaintiffs are going to need to show three things. First, that material support was provided.
Mm-hmm.
Second, knowledge. And third, causation. The knowledge requirement is going to be really interesting if we see a case proceed this far. Because generally, what this has been interpreted to mean is that the person or entity here that provided the material support knew that it was providing material support to a terrorist group. That's really all that's required here. So it doesn't need to know that its support is actually furthering terrorism or furthering illegal activities, but knowledge about the organization's connection to terrorism is enough. And here, I think the common response would be, well, how does Twitter know that a particular account is owned by ISIS? And
right.
Is it Twitter's responsibility to go through every account? I mean, how many accounts does Twitter have and how many pop up on a daily basis? Is that even possible?
Right.
And is that fair? And I think those are the types of questions that are going to be debated as we go forward. But I can tell you already that the U.S. government and other governments around the world have specifically called out accounts to Twitter, saying, we know these accounts to be associated with designated foreign terrorist organizations, and please remove these accounts. And that Twitter does not always and does really not often comply with those requests. And that information is available on Twitter's transparency report, which I almost laugh when I say that it's their transparency report because it's a pretty opaque document. Twitter makes a lot of numbers available but doesn't really tell us what's behind them. And Twitter has said, yeah, we've had, you know, X number of requests from the U.S. government in the second half of 2016 to remove accounts for any number of reasons, and this is how many times we've complied. And the the percentage of compliance is either zero or exceptionally low.
Is Twitter's and Facebook's interests only economic, or are there some free expression issues going on here?
Well, I mean, I think those are really intertwined. So Twitter has long boasted itself as a defender of free speech online.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the government is not in a position to control the speech that happens on these social networks. But Twitter has tried to remain as free space as possible, to foster as much free expression as possible, and has been as reluctant as any other entity at allowing others to remove content and or the government to dictate what type of content could be removed. Facebook has been actually a lot more receptive to government takedown requests and working with authorities. And I think both of them are probably trying to achieve some type of economic gain. There has to be some recognition that users of their networks are going to be turned off by a company that lets terrorism propagate on its network and does nothing about it. And that's Facebook's approach. And I think Twitter's approach is that users are going to be really turned off when it starts policing their content and determining what is permissible and what is not. And I think that's where the line becomes really difficult to draw. It's very easy to maybe look at one post that is, you know, a clear call for terrorist action and say, okay, this is problematic. But what about somebody expressing sympathy with, you know, ISIS or a belief held by that organization? Is that also problematic and requires removal, or is that something else? And I think Twitter has taken the position of it doesn't want to make that determination. And so it's drawn the line at really not removing content.
So is this, does this an ultimate slippery slope? You mentioned earlier that each time a suit is filed, Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter become more proactive about fighting terrorist abuse of their platforms. In the end, whether the plaintiffs win or lose, the natural consequence of the legal exposure, you know, created for these companies will likely lead to a safer social media. Yes, but what about unfettered suppression?
Right. So I'll give you a recent example of, you know, just this week, YouTube has announced that when it can't shut down videos because they don't violate, you know, specifically terrorist videos or other really controversial videos because they don't violate their guidelines, YouTube is going to bury that content using its algorithms. YouTube is going to bury it. A lawsuit was filed last month against YouTube. That's a pretty aggressive lawsuit on this material support statute. And look at this. Just a month later, YouTube has taken a really affirmative step to make its platform safer. It's responding. It's responding to the lawsuit. And the lawsuit may not proceed, you know, even into discovery. It may be dismissed at an early stage. This has happened every time these lawsuits have been filed, dating back to the first one that was dismissed. After it was filed in January, Twitter immediately removed over 126,000 accounts identified as belonging to terrorist organizations. It had not done anything before that point. So the point that I was trying to make in the article is that even if these lawsuits don't ultimately result in successes for the plaintiffs, mm-hmm. what they're doing is forcing social networks to realize that they have to take some steps to make their sites a little bit more safe for users, for end users. They have to respond to some of this pressure that's being levied, you know, by virtue of these lawsuits, even if it's not liability.
You know we're talking about terrorism here, but do you see any way going forward that these this approach and the policies that they establish in response to the lawsuits could start to, you know, leak into other areas of life?
I'm not sure I understand. What other areas
other things that people want to suppress?
I see what you're saying. You know, I'm not really concerned about that because I honestly don't see the social networks as taking such great strides as to restrict speech. I think what the networks will do is will take steps to make the platforms safer without really restricting speech, enhancing content moderation, responding faster to user flags, but not necessarily removing speech itself. I think that, you know, there is, if I think on the other side of the token, if social networks are exposed to liability, I believe it could fundamentally change the freedoms that those networks currently offer users, mm-hmm. and the platforms could really shrink in what they offer. I don't see it as being dramatic in the other, going okay. the other direction.
And then just one more question as far as the government goes and its efforts to track terrorist networks on social media. Hypothetically, if social media got rid of all the terrorist networks, I mean, isn't that a tool out there that they also use?
Right. So the government, since actually about December of 2015, has been working with social media companies in Silicon Valley to try to figure out ways to facilitate some transfer of information. But in what we've been talking about, mm-hmm. the social networks have not been really transparent with the government. So they've been trying to help the government with some other tools, but not specifically with shutting down or tracking certain accounts. So I'm not sure that by making the, I don't think that it's mutually exclusive. I think that the networks can make their platforms safer and at the same time not shut down this avenue of potentially cooperating with the government to track down terrorists.
Nina Brown, thanks for joining us. I appreciate your time today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Nina Brown recently wrote about the issue of terrorist networks on social media and the culpability of social media for that, for Slate. We'll have a link to that article on our website at WOSU.org. Nina is an assistant professor at the Newhouse School of Public Communications at Syracuse University. More Tech Tuesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Last summer, Pokemon Go was all the rage. Now there's a new system in the game that will change how it's played. Joining us to talk about that and other tech news is Russell Holley. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
For those who've been living in a cave, refresh our memories about Pokemon Go and the phenomenon it became.
Yeah, so last year, Pokemon Go became this game on your phone where you had to walk into the real world. You had to actually go outside into the sun and do these things in the digital world. And in return, you got creatures that you could use to, you know, gain points and earn victory awards and things like that. So there was this whole gaming component where you had to physically be at all of these different locations. And the more of those locations you went to, then the greater chance of success you had in doing a lot of different things inside of the game.
So the company behind Pokemon Go, they've upped the ante. There's a new and improved game. And what's different about it?
Yeah, so this actually goes back to the very beginning of Pokemon Go, the original announcement video that was made. There were things happening in that video that never actually came to the game when it was released last summer, where people could all, you know, instead of being kind of a single-player game, there were elements where people could come together and do things in order to gain more rare versions of Pokemon and things like that. And those elements of the game did not exist when it came out last summer, but they are coming to the game now, and in order to do that, Niantic kind of had to break some of the things that people are familiar with in the game right now. So as of yesterday, gyms, the physical things that you would go to in the game called gyms, don't work. They've been completely pulled down. If you try to go to them, they're not going to do much of anything. And they are going to be rebuilt in the next couple of weeks with a new system that they're calling raids. And a big part of the raid system is up to 20 people in a physical place can come together in that physical place and all play this game together in order to defeat, you know, kind of larger monsters and win greater rewards. And it's this kind of continuation of the knowledge that there are more people directly encouraged to be outside in groups playing this game.
So I'm already envisioning people bumping into each other all the place. All of a sudden you see a park and people are staring at their phones and they're bumping into each other.
That's absolutely something that has already happened in this game. You know, there are videos in Central Park in New York where there are hundreds of people playing this game, looking down at their phones, looking down briefly and then running through the park to find, you know, something that someone on the other side of the park has discovered. So it's definitely something that not only will likely happen, but is happening now.
There's more competition in the game. That means more of those meetups you just described, more interaction in real time. What kind of competition? They're competing for things now. It's just not, you're just not one-upping yourself. You're getting the guy next to you.
A big part of the gym aspect is taking your greatest, creature and putting it in this place for other people to come and battle. And so that system has been increased, you know, both by this raid system where you can now capture these more powerful and more rare creatures, but also kind of building towards this system where you and your team are working together to create the best, you know, basically squad of six creatures that can sit on this gym for other people to come and fight. And so it becomes this big group effort, not just for you know, every single person to come and work together to try and take down these larger creatures, but also for specifically within your personal team to work together in order to make sure that you can kind of hold this ground, make sure that this place that has been marked as a gym is you know, belongs to your team.
Well, I mean, do they visualize people going out in packs together, or do they visualize people on their own meeting up with people, strangers that they've never met before, and becoming a pack?
There are elements of both that have already happened in the game. You know, when you start the game, you get to choose one of three different factions that you you align yourself with. And so there are people, you know, for the last year, you know, anytime I go out and play the game with my kids and I see someone else playing, one of the very first things that I will hear from either a stranger or, you know, one of my kids saying to a stranger is, what team are you on? As soon as they figure out that person is also playing. And my my oldest daughter actually gets kind of salty with people when they're not on the team that she's on. You know, they've been like, oh, well, I'm on this other team. And she's like, oh, okay, cool. I don't want to talk to you anymore. I was like, that's rude. We don't talk to strangers like that. But yeah, it's, you know, and we have friends that are on other teams that she just doesn't even talk to sometimes. She's, you know, if she's been beaten by someone from that team recently, she very much holds a grudge. But it's, you know, it ends up being a very friendly kind of neutral way to meet strangers as well. You know, there have been people playing this game who have become very close friends through the game. And a large portion of the problems that this game had initially were people playing solo and other people coming and taking advantage of them. Mm-hmm. And that gets decreased pretty considerably when you introduce these group mechanics, where it is directly encouraged for there to be, you know, groups of 20 people playing this game. That significantly decreases the chances of something like that happening this summer.
Yeah, so your daughter's still into it. You're still into it with your kids. How many people are still into Pokemon Go before the shutdown?
Niantic hasn't announced any figures as far as how many active players they have every month, but mm-hmm. they announced a big celebration event that they're doing in Chicago in a couple of weeks where, you know, they're going to kind of unveil this new feature. And the tickets for that event sold out in 6 minutes.
Oh, my gosh.
So there's a pretty significant number of people still playing the game.
The writer, the person who wrote this article, called these prospects that you're talking about both terrifying and great. What's terrifying?
Well, really, it's, you know, there's an anxiety component to being out with strangers and dealing with that. And, you know, a lot of the, like I said, there are videos of, you know, dozens of people sprinting through a park at, you know, what's basically sunset in order to you know, catch a Pokemon. We're now dealing with events where there are going to be gyms in public places where there could be these raid events at any hour of the day, basically, where it's going to be not uncommon for you to see 15 or 20 people just kind of camped in the middle of a park or, you know, something like that to you know, try to work together to do this. And that can be a little unnerving and alarming.
Tedium was another worry.
Well, you know, any game where there's a repetitive concept, you know, in order to accomplish a goal, you know, that's a concern. And it's something that Niantic has historically been pretty good at, is balancing it so that it doesn't feel tedious and repetitive over time. But it is, you know, it's an active concern with this kind of thing.
Do you think they'll lose people?
I don't. I think this is going to bring people who had stopped playing over the winter back mm-hmm. to do more, because this is one of several changes that is going to encourage a lot of, you know, kind of cross cooperative play. And that it really kind of sets the stage for things like trading Pokemon in between players, which is a big part of the Nintendo version of these games, is being able to trade, you know, between people. And by giving these tools to make it so that you can really do more than just have the same creature that everyone else has, you know, it makes the possibility for something like trading to be introduced at the end of the summer a lot more promising.
Which is, of course, the classic relationship with Pokemon in the beginning.
Right, yeah, and it's the kind of thing that has been, you know, sorely missed by people who have played all of the Pokemon games and then went to play this, mm-hmm. is that they've worked really hard to create these things, but they can't get everything because, you know, not all Pokemon are available in all places. There are some that are very region specific, and so being able to trade those things has always been, you know, an element to this game.
I've tried it a couple times. I think it is fun. After all the time you've been doing it, especially with your kids, what kind of recommendations would you give people who want to get started with their kids? How would you say to get going? That is when it's back up, running.
So, I mean, the biggest thing is to plan your day out. You know specifically where it is that you want to go and how long you want to be outside when you're playing. A lot of parks have multiple stops that you can walk in between, so it ends up being, you know, kind of a large circle that you can walk. And that way, by the time you get back to your car, everyone's participated, everyone's felt good about, you know, the experience, and then they can kind of get in the car and go. Any time that you can plan out something like that and do that at least, you know, once or twice a week ends up being a really positive experience for everyone involved.
And also they're putting the changes in motion. The gyms are going to be disabled.
The gyms are completely down now.
They're down now. When will they be back up?
There's an estimation that they'll be back up within the next 2 weeks.
Okay. All right. Well, let us know how it goes with that. We just have a few minutes left, but I wanted to talk about a smart lock for a home. What is a smart lock?
Yeah. So, the smart locks are frequently deadbolts or locks that are attached to the primary lock on your front door that can respond to something other than a key being pressed in to unlock it. Some are proximity based, where you can kind of walk up and, you know, by recognizing the encrypted key on your phone, that lock knows that you're nearby and so kind of automatically unlocks the door for you.
Like with cars and their fobs.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
A lot of similar ideas are being used there. And some of them can be completely unlocked remotely, where you don't have to be near it at all. And because that lock is connected to the internet, you can just kind of log in through your phone and say, go ahead and unlock this door if you were traveling and needed someone to come into your house or something like that. I've been using a lot of these over the course of a couple of years. The first generation of these, I kind of largely said to a lot of people, don't bother with, because they just kind of existed because attaching the word smart to something made it so that you could sell something. but really, you know, they were kind of expensive and also kind of dangerous. You know, when you connect something like this to the internet, it's a lock to your house. And if that can be breached because your Wi-Fi network has been, accessed or something like that, then that causes a vulnerability into your home that you don't really have a lot of control over. The second generation of these locks have gotten a great deal more secure. The companies that have survived kind of that first generation have gotten a lot smarter about how these things are being used. But it's still really important if you're considering a smart lock for your home to know how the technology that you're installing in your home works. You know, what ways it could potentially be taken advantage of, and how to make sure that you are still keeping your home safe by having a fancy lock on your door.
What do the best locks have going for them?
A lot of them are, you know, it's an added convenience. You know, for someone like me, I already have my phone in my hand when I'm walking up to my front door. And do not always necessarily have keys if I have, you know, gone for a walk or have been out with friends or something like that. And so, you know, being able to interact with that lock without needing a physical key or something like that is convenient. And then that really ultimately ends up being the biggest thing there is I can share a key virtually with someone if I know that they are watching my home for me. I don't have to know that, you know, I don't have to see them before I go to make sure that they're handed a physical key. I just have to know that they have their phone and that I have given them basically a password to my house that I can then revoke at any time. They can't make a copy of that password. I have a lot more control over that, unlike a physical key that can, you know, where a copy can be made.
And is this as far as what's out of the market now that you do like, is it you get what you pay for kind of a thing, or are they, what about the pricing?
No, pricing really, I don't want to say it doesn't matter, but it matters a lot less than you might think. You know, spending $300 or $400 on a lock is not a guarantee that you are buying something more secure than you know, a $75 or $120 lock for your door. One of the ones that I tend to recommend is one made by Kwikset called Kibo. The second generation of these locks is very much one of these proximity-based locks where you physically tap the lock and then you know that it's working.
Mm-hmm. Russell Holly, thanks as always for joining us today. Appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
It's Russell Holly, contributing editor at Android Central. At Android Central. That's it for Tech Tuesday today on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Thanks for listening.